First Samuel chapter 12. Samuel addresses Israel. Then Samuel said to all Israel, "Behold, I have listened to your voice and all that you said to me, and I have appointed a king over you. And now, here is a king walking before you, but I am old and gray. And behold, my sons are with you, and I have walked before you from my youth even to this day. Here I am. Bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? I will restore it to you." And they said, "You have not defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hands." And he said to them, "The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have found nothing in my hand." And they said, "He is witness." Then Samuel said to the people, "It is the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron, and who brought your fathers up from the hand, from the land of Egypt. So now, take your stand, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord which he did for you and your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and your fathers cried out to the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt, and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God. So he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of army of Hazar, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. And they cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. But now deliver us from the hands of our enemies and we will serve thee.' Then the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Baden and Jephthah and Samuel and deliver you from the hands of your enemies all around so that you can live securely." The king confirmed, "When you saw that Nahash, the kings of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king.' Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. And if you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. Even now, take your stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. It is not the wheat harvest today. I will call to the Lord that he may send thunder and rain. Then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourself a king." So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Then all the people said to Samuel, "Pray for your servants to the Lord your God, so that we may not die. For we have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king." And Samuel said to the people, "Do not fear. You have committed all this evil. Yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And you must not turn aside, for then you will go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver because they are futile. For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, but I will instruct you in the good and right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king shall be swept away."
Thank you, Hector. That was 1 Samuel chapter 12. Before I begin my little spiel, Any comments or questions? Something that caught your attention that said, that doesn't make sense, or why would that happen? Or there is in fact one, I don't know if you caught that, but maybe you didn't. There was some oddity on Samuel's recollection of history. Maybe it's due to his old age, I'm not quite sure. But, as far as the sequence of events, but any comments or things that you would have questions about? Yes.
I think it's interesting that the people, I mean, they acknowledge their sin, but they also recognize that there was no turning back either. And it's almost as if they were accepting of the consequences that were going to come.
Right.
Unlike when God had told them to go up in the wilderness and, you know, fight, and they refused, but then they changed their minds and went up, and he said,
too late.
Not to go, because I'm not going with them.
Yeah, yeah. The consequences are permanent, so to speak. And they're willing to accept them in this case, which is quite unique. Well, I should say unique. Samuel did address this issue back a few chapters ago. They had the opportunity to say, okay, never mind. But they said, no, we want it anyway. That's a whole ball of wax comes with everything. Yes, Susan.
I think it's interesting that this takes place at the wheat harvest, which puts it at the Feast of Shavuot.
Right toward the wheat harvest in Israel. Israel's seasons are a little different than U.S., in case you're not aware of that. We harvest wheat sometime around July, August. That's because our wheat-growing regions stop receiving rain and snow sometime around March-ish or so. April. Israel stops receiving rain and snow around March, a whole month earlier. So their wheat dries out earlier than ours does. Thus, they start their harvest sometime in June, give or take, May, June-ish. That's when the wheat starts to dry out, which, of course, is Shavuot, which is a celebration, a holy day.
Which is interesting, because it has some elements of a covenant renewal, which is the word Shavuot can mean oaths.
Yes.
So an oath is always like oaths are being taken here. And traditionally, you can make an argument in the Old Testament for covenant renewal taking place at, Shavuot, all the way from Noah on. So here you can see that there is some sort of a covenant renewal of sorts.
Yes.
Because Samuel has just repeated their history.
Yes, exactly, which is a key point. And he did it at this wonderful little town called Gilgal. In case you don't remember, Gilgal is the whole rolling away where all the people crossed the big Jordan River when Joshua was coming through. It was big. Anytime something bad happened, they all went back to Gilgal. It's okay, we got to fix this. What do? We fix it. We do the X, Y, Z. Let's reiterate our connection to God. Gilgal is the key little town that they created with the rolling. It's the circumcision of men with the rolling away the foreskin is what the word comes from. But rolling away, what is used, or that the way it's used in Joshua, is the rolling away the reproach of God, rolling away the stuff that God hates about us. That's the point of the town of why Samuel chooses this town to address that one main issue, which is to reestablish yourself with Him. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Julie.
In verse 20, it stands out to me that he tells them, even though they've done this sin, to serve the Lord with all your heart.
Yes. Which is okay. You can still serve Him after you've sinned.
Just that he said it, it jumps out at me.
Well, good. It should jump out at you. Because they're in great concern at that moment in time. A lot of it has to do with what Samuel just did, with the whole rain and the thunder in the middle of summer, which doesn't happen in Israel. Which, what does that do to your wheat crop, by the way? It's history. You lost it. You don't have wheat that year. It's a detrimental effect. It was not a desire. Oh wow, interesting. No, it was, holy cow, I'm going to have people who's going to starve to death now. There's some of members of my family who will not eat this year, or kind of thing. It's a significant issue, which of course we're all concerned. Great, God's going to kill us now. He might as well. We could have starved to death, but there's other alternatives. So it's a significant, important fact that you can still, in spite of the consequences, in spite of the sins, still serve God. You still have that ability. We always have that option and choice. Let's see here. Well, I'm just going to go into my little spiel, so I hope you don't mind. First of all, as I already mentioned earlier, that this is the continuation of chapter 11. This is at Gilgal. This is the, so to speak, of a farewell address as Samuel being the military leader, not the spiritual leader, just the military leader. He's still around, but he can still reprimand people, and he does, in particular the kings, when they screw up. He's still around doing things, and as we already discussed in previous chapters, Saul was never anointed king. He was anointed prince or ruler over. The distinction in the words which God chose to distinguish king versus non-king. The people then said, he is our king, using Melchizedek, actually the one who was in charge of. Yes,
Samuel,
Tammy.
Samuel, over and over again in the Hebrew in this chapter, uses the term...
Correct, because the people had selected in chapter 8, when Samuel actually anointed Saul, said, all right, he is now our king. They now refer to him as king. And in this chapter, chapter 11 as well, the one before this, the people finally said, okay, we are accepting him as our king, which, of course, that has to include Samuel as being a member of the people. He's still a king. God didn't use the term king, which is the distinction I'm making here. God used the term as, he is the guy who is militarily in charge. God doesn't use the word king for anointing someone until he's referring to David. That's God's king, the one God has chosen to be king, not just guy who's interim doing some work for him. Saul's nothing more than a glorified judge, essentially. That's the distinction which God has selected for him. And of course, we can go through that again if we wish to, but I'm not going to go through it today. So this, essentially, this is Samuel's slap in the face back to the people for them slapping him in the face a few chapters ago by saying, we don't like you anymore. This is an opportunity for Samuel to say, all right, I've given you what you asked for, though it may be detrimental to you. I've given it to you anyway. You slapped me earlier by saying, I'm not good enough to be your ruler, so to speak, your judge. And my sons are not good enough to be your judge. And in particular, the key point that God is no longer allowed to be your king. That's a pretty heavy hit when it's your responsibility as a judge to make the people not choose that choice. That's Samuel's job, to make people choose God and continually choose God. Well, on his watch, after the past almost 400 years, they finally said, no, on his watch. That's a devastating thing to have happen. This is not a pleasant event. This is difficult for Samuel. He didn't like it, but he has to accept it anyway. Why? Because God's will that it happen. This is not something out of the blue that was never expected, never anticipated. God gave rules to Moses about when they accept a king, when they wish to have a king. These are rules that must be followed. So rules were already established for a king. Samuel knew those rules. Everyone knew those rules. They already knew how it was supposed to happen. It's just, who's the unlucky person is going to happen on their watch? Samuel got selected. He was the last guy. What was the people's reason, if you recall, as to why they did not choose or wanted a king at this point in time in Samuel's life? What was the people's reason? What were they were citing a particular problem. They said, we want a king now instead of you.
To be like the other nations.
And what was their inherent drawback of being like the other nations?
Well, you're either going to be God's peculiar people.
There's no longer a distinction anymore.
Like the other nations?
Yeah, you're no longer a distinction anymore. But there's a man who's now responsible. There's a person they can say, okay, we'll follow him or no, we'll kill him. Kings don't always live forever. So there's a single person they can look at. They can point to that person and his genetic line, not just the random selection that God chooses, which he had been doing for the past almost 370 years at this point, that he had been choosing people through judges from Moses all the way through until Samuel. He's been selecting a judge from different family lines, all of them varying characters and quality. There was no rhyme or reason for God's choosing one or another. Just when he needed them, at that moment in time, they were selected. Some were better, morally speaking, than others. Jephthah, he was a killer. That's what he did. He did that for a living. He killed people. He was an assassin. For all practical purposes, he will kill you, take your money. And yet, he becomes one of the more powerful judges, because God said, you know what, you're really good at killing people. I need you right now. That's what happened. They said, what did Jephthah do? He got people together and said, okay, let's go kill the bad guys. They all killed bad guys, which, of course, being his marauding technique and his abilities, who was he killing all this time? Were the bad guys. He was just, now instead of a small scale thing, it was a big scale, same principle. A very well-educated individual as well. He knew his history, quite detailed history. He knew how Israel worked. He knew how Ammon and Moab were going. That was the whole battle as far as who owned what property. So God selects somebody not because they're morally superior. It's because they are needed at that moment in time, good or bad. He chose people that were, we would call, consider, should belong in prison or for various other reasons, have no business being out in public. But yet he chose them anyway because they were who he needed. Samuel's no different. At this moment in time, Israel needed him. Recall, why did he choose Samuel? What was going on? Well, God had a corrupt high priest, Eli, with his two sons. This is a corruption issue. God did not take kindly to corruption. That is one particular thing he is extremely upset with, is corruption. One of the reasons why God said with Eli and all of your sons, you and your descendants are now cursed. There is no repair for this. There is no sacrifice. There is no repentance for this. End of story. That's it. And of course, now we have history and record of their descendants that's exactly what happened. They die extremely young, prematurely, usually in their 30s and 40s, most of the males. And of course, Eli and all of his sons died. All in one day. So the curse that God said, and why was he so upset? Because they made all the people corrupt by doing their own corruption and destroying all of their sacrifices they were offering that they believed were right. And in fact, they were evil, unacceptable. God doesn't take kindly to leaders being corrupt. That's just the nature of him. So, but one of the other citations along that line, the people said, this is back in chapter, I think it says 8 or 9. Oh, sorry, 7 or 8, I remember. Referring to Samuel's two sons, Joel and Bijah. They said, Samuel, your sons aren't like you. They go after whatever the biggest dollar is. They judge according to who has the money. We need to not have this anymore. We can't tolerate them being judges after you die. Give us a king. To be like the other nations. To have lineage descendants that are superior to yours, Samuel. Personal rejection of a father to his sons. That's hard to take as well. This guy took a lot. So that's one of the citations, but of course it's corruption. Are they wrong?
Like no.
What was that?
They're like corporations.
In what manner?
Everything, the bottom line,
money. Well, his sons were ill repute. They were not very decent people. Not that they didn't know what God was, what God wanted, or knew how to do the tasks assigned. They just would go after whoever had the biggest dollar for dictating what was right, what was wrong. Of course, extremely uncouth, unacceptable. What was that?
That hasn't happened.
Oh, no, I've never heard that ever happen anymore. Now, nobody ever takes bribes for any reason, right? So Samuel's address, you know, he does not say, did me and my family take all these various things in verse 3 and 4, does he? Of course not. Why? Because he knows better. His sons did do all these various, not all, but some of these various things. What I find most interesting, and I hope you find it as well, Samuel is a Levite, right? We already knew that. Elkanah, it goes through his lineage descendants in the First Chronicles. What family of Levi is he from? I'll guess you what. It's the one guy that we all say, oh, what an idiot. During Moses' time, the earth swallows him up. And Korah! He is a descendant of Korah. Not just any family, it's Korah that he's a descendant of. Which, when you read the account, which actually we'll go, might as well go there. This is recorded in Numbers chapter 16. So the discussion of the rebellion of Korah. Numbers 16, this is recorded against Moses and Aaron. We're not going to read the entire chapter, it takes forever. But we're going to read just the portion of it. Let's see, verse You know, I think we'll start in verse 12. Moses, of course, is asking people to come together because Korah had already said, "Hey, Moses, Aaron, are you any better than we are? Did God actually choose you? Or because we're also Levites, we're equally holy. Why didn't God choose us?" Well, they're going through this whole process. All right, let's bring your censors forward. We'll let God make the selection. Of course, Korah with amongst his people are there as well. Moses sends a call out to all these various people that are supporters of Korah, and it says, verse 12, he sends out to a call to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they said, "We will not come up. It is a small thing that you have brought us up out of the land of Egypt, with milk flowing with milk and honey, to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a prince over us. Moreover, you have not brought us into the land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put the eyes out of these men? We will not come up." This verse 15. This is a beautiful point in time, which you really get to see the heart of Moses. Yep. Then Moses was very angry, and he said to the Lord, "Do not graciously accept their offering." This is Korah's offering, and there's various of the people who are supporting him. "I have not taken one donkey from them, nor have I hurt one of them." Let's stop there for a second. Sounds similar to Samuel's response to the people. "I have not hurt any of you. I've not taken anything from you." There's a reason why Samuel was very well versed, and he used the phraseology again in his time to refer how his descendants and ancestors were once treated back then. Rightfully, both categories are right. Moses was right in this case, and Samuel's right in this case. But Samuel uses that. Moses said to Korah, "Tomorrow you and all your company present before the Lord, you and they, as well as Aaron. If you take a censer, put incense into it, and each of you bring a censer before the Lord, 250 censers, you also and Aaron, each of you with the censer." Of course, I'm not going to go through the whole story. Everyone brings forth, God selects Aaron, not Korah. So Korah's followers, including most of his family, no, not all of them, because clearly Samuel's still around, get consumed up and die. They're trash. And of course, the people that did not come, their tents get swallowed up where they're at too, and they die as well. So along with their families, that's God doesn't take kindly to various rebellions. So Samuel, being a descendant of Korah, had this act essentially put upon his ancestors. Meaning an act of rebellion. People saying, "I don't like you anymore. I don't want you anymore. I wish to do better than this." Well, with his ancestors 370 years earlier, actually more like 380 years, actually, thereabouts, same thing's happening to him. Reverse scenario, though. Instead of his descendants being the rebellions against Moses, the people's rebelling against him. They're all rebelling against who? God. That didn't change. That never changed. But what I found interesting is that when Moses said, "God, do not accept their offering," he actually was telling God what to do. When Samuel here addresses God, "Send rain and thunder, which will destroy the crops and injure your people," God listened. He actually told God what to do. Both times, God listened to men, didn't he? Both times he did. Actually, many, many times. I'm just referring to just two of them. Actually, he does it for Joshua. He does it for Moses a few more times after this. And does it Aaron and Phinehas. And does a few others too. But at this point in time, I'm pointing out that in spite of how detrimental it may be to the individual who is receiving it, God may still listen to them and do it anyway. Another way words of wording this. Though it may be detrimental to us, me as an individual, if I ask something of God, and I don't know how detrimental it may be, he may give it to me anyway. That's a tough thing to think about. It could destroy me. I could ask for something and be begging for something and want something so deeply and so thoroughly that I think this is the right way to choose. And God may say, "You know what? That's not the right way to choose. But I'm going to give it to you anyway. And you're going to suffer all the consequences that come with it." God listening to a man. Was it God's will that Korah die? Well, most would argue, no, it wasn't his will, but Korah chose to rebel, so thus he died. Was it God's will that all the crops during Samuel's time get destroyed? Well, actually, technically, it was not his will to get them all destroyed. But he listened to Samuel to teach a lesson. He was teaching them a lesson. Listening to a man. It's an unusual thing. I don't usually think about God listening to me and saying, okay, Daniel, in spite of this is not what I actually would like for you to do, I'm going to make it happen anyway for you and let you suffer it. I don't usually think about that on my own personal life, but it actually is in fact true. He does that. What do you think we pray for? We pray for things all the time, that God will listen to our will. Sometimes he listens, sometimes he does so, though maybe to our own personal detriment. This is no different in this scenario. Yeah, exactly. And there's no going back, unfortunately. He doesn't usually go back.
Was just as equally mad as Moses was.
Well, because Korah rebelled.
Right. Because he rebelled. Although, I mean, yes, in a sense, you're saying God listened.
Well, Korah can at that moment in time.
They both were
right.
But
Korah can at that point in time say, "I'm going to offer my offering of repentance instead."
Right.
And we don't know the heart. He didn't. We don't know the heart of Korah until after it's already done. God knows. We don't.
Right.
So the anger is there. I'm not saying that God wouldn't have done it had Moses not asked. I'm saying the fact that Moses asked and God did it. If the sequence of events happened. Samuel's no different. Samuel asked and then God did it. God may have wanted to do it. Of course, we don't have it recorded down. But most likely not, because this is detrimental to all the people, not just the good and the bad. It's detrimental to all. Yes.
Joshua asked
many times.
And it's almost just still.
It's still, right. Now, if you were Chinese at that moment in time, that would be extremely detrimental to you. If you were, Polynesian, that would be also extremely detrimental to you, because that's where the area in which you were living. What was happening in China at that moment in time? Well, records of massive fires. Well, imagine middle of actually about late spring or so, the sun standing and just beating down on you for roughly 24 hours. Yeah, that'll cause fires. And of course, a lot of fires recorded. They're called Polynesia. There's the sun, the eternal sunset, which the sun is sitting and it won't go down. That's a matter of mass distress to most people. And of course, U.S. has records of the eternal darkness. But same thing, all at the same time. So depending on who you were, it may be detrimental to you or not. But God listening to a man. It's quite interesting to see. Okay, so let's move on, because there's actually another point I want to talk about. The point starts through in verse 8. Let's see if I find verse 8. Let's see, 9, 7, 8. Okay. This is, of course, his record of history, which is perfectly fine. When Jacob came to Egypt, you and your fathers cried out to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron. They brought out your forefathers to Egypt and settled them in this place. Verse 9. But they forgot the Lord, their God, delivered them to his hands, blah, blah, blah. Let's keep going. Verse 10. And then they cried out to the Lord again. We have sinned, please forgive us. So he listens to them. And the Lord sent, of course, these various people. Yerubbaal, Badan. By the way, Badan is a contraction of Ben-Dan, which is referring to Samson, in case you're not aware of that. Badan is an alternative name. So, sent Yerubbaal, Samson, Jephthah, and, of course, refers himself in third person, Samuel. Rescue from your enemies all around. Stop there for a second. The citation Samuel's giving, what were the reactions of the people when bad things happened? What did they do?
Cried out to the Lord.
Cried to the Lord, right. Did they cry out to King? Did they cry out to Joe Schmuck number two? They didn't cry out to anybody, did they? They cried out only to God. Why is it, as Sam was asking, that now, this time, though this Nosh and various other problems are minor and compared to back with Jacob, they're crying out to, instead of God, to a man. They want a king instead. He's asking them this question, essentially. Though he's not waiting for an answer. He's just asking them this open-ended question. They're actually, at this point in time, they've chosen, though it is such a minor scenario, we now quit. We're forgetting the things that God did for us. We could have cried out to him, and yes, he would have saved us, but we're not going to. We now choose a man to follow. Which, of course, stems the whole reason as to why Samuel does this whole miracle with the rain and the thunder. Because they didn't need a king. They had the right man right there. What king could do that? Could David say, God, make it rain here and destroy these crops? No. Could King Manasseh do so? Definitely not. None of the kings could do that. None of the kings were that, quote, righteous to do this, that holy. And they all noted, they all witnessed, Samuel, you did no wrong to us. He was the best choice for them. But yet they still rejected him. Yes, Susan.
I think going back to what I said earlier about the timing of this at Shavuot and oaths and so on and so forth, it's really very interesting in here because you've got Samuel asking for thunder. And it's just very reminiscent of Sinai, where the people had sinned with the golden calf, and then they get the thunder,
and
they're shaking, and it's God's voice, and they immediately then cry out to God.
Exactly.
You have exactly
the same thing.
Totally a repeat of what happened at Sinai. I mean, Samuel is definitely pointing out, look, you've got this king, hear his voice.
Yeah. He's so much more powerful than what you had ever wanted.
Yeah.
But yet they still rejected him. Which is, it's a great point what Samuel's bringing out, that even their forefathers knew better than this. I remember the guys, that even Korah, who we just talked about, got sucked up and destroyed, and all of the various followers, they knew better than to call out for a king. And yet these people apparently don't. They don't get the fact that their king is so much more greater, how powerful than they could ever have asked for.
Can I just share one more detail? Recently, it was in the news, and I'd seen it, and then Jeff and Tammy sent me an article. At Gilgal, they have found these stone feet, huge feet,
I heard about that.
Carved into the rock at their places. Now, Gilgal is where Joshua celebrated the Passover when they came in into the land of Canaan.
Yep.
Now, the big stone foot is Regel. Now, God calls the appointed times Regalim. In other words, it is three times that God sets his foot down as king into the lives of the Israelites at Passover, at Shavuot, and Tabernacles. And that's the first one there, Passover. It seems appropriate that, well, for what is happening with Passover, with Shavuot, with God as king, that it is at Gilgal.
At that
they
place.
Have this huge foot there. God is their
quite
king.
Quite visible. Quite visible.
Yes.
And the reason why it points out in early in the chapter is that they're there before the Lord. Before the Lord. Before the Lord. Well, the Lord wasn't there. In case you weren't aware of that, history points out he wasn't there anymore. Remember, he went to Shiloh. Shiloh got wiped out. Now he's hanging out in some town down here in Judah. He's not at Gilgal. He's not even close to it. But yet he's still there before the Lord? How is that possible? Well, the point that she's bringing up, that is, it's because it's a historical site that God said, this is the beginning. This is where we will start. So they are before him, in a manner of speaking. It's a perfect time of year, too. Okay, so yes, it says, your forefathers knew better than this. Of course, you clearly do not. So he rejected them all and said, okay, let's move on. Wheat harvest, he brings the rain to cut. Now, of course, like I mentioned before, time of year. This is summertime. They, of course, wipe out the entire wheat harvest. And I pointed out, people will starve. Some may starve to death. Not likely all of them, because they had the whole spring of collecting of fruit, vegetables, and grains as well. Because grains, some of the grains do start showing up in spring. So not that everybody necessarily died. And, of course, you still have the grape harvest. Various other things that can happen in the fall. So it's a very short period of time. But some may have actually, in fact, starved to death, depending on where you happen to live. That's when they said, okay, we quit. We'll get back. We're sorry. Do-over? Why isn't that working? If I screw up, don't I get to say, God, I'm sorry? Well, how come they don't? Yes, Tammy.
Of course you can say you're sorry and you repent, but that doesn't mean you're not going to have some consequence for whatever you did or didn't do.
Exactly. Consequences don't go away just because I said I'm sorry. If I go break the law, like go speeding down 100 miles an hour and get a ticket, oh, I'm sorry, officer, I won't speed anymore. That's great. Here's a ticket anyway. And don't speak anymore, but he's taking it anyway. I mean, there are consequences that come out no matter what you say or how sorry you may feel, the consequences are still there.
This was deliberate sinning.
They purposely chose.
In the Torah, Samuel was telling them, God is your king, you don't need a king. They insisted on it. It was deliberate.
It was. There was, although now they said they're sorry, it's too late.
Forgiveness and consequences are two different things.
Yes, they are. And no, God did forgive them. He gave them David. He gave them more things than they could ever ask for. So he did obviously say, okay, we're going to make through this. By the way, David is alive, in case you're not aware of this. David's roughly in his late teens, probably early 20s at this point in time, along with his brothers, and of course, Jonathan, who's one of his best friends, who's Saul's son. They're all alive, and they're hearing and knowing and seeing and doing all this stuff. They know what's going on. Jesse is most likely there, along with a few of his sons at Gilgal, listening to this. Samuel may not know him by name, but he's probably there listening. Let's see. Now, where went this one? You know what? Yeah, I'll rattle off anyway. I wasn't sure if I was going to cover this or not. Why didn't God... I should say, why didn't. Let's reword that a little bit. Back during Moses' time, the people said, we're sorry, right? Many times. More times than they probably needed to. Because they screwed up many times, they should have. But they said, we're sorry. And God said, Moses, stand aside. I'm going to kill these people off. They are unacceptable to me. They're too much. I can't take this anymore. I can do better with you. You're technically a descendant of Abraham, so it still counts. So I'll just make your descendants great. I'll start over. It's a do-over from the other's perspective. Instead of like, God, please forgive me, so I want to do it. No, he says, oh, I'm not going to forgive you. I'm going to do over and wipe it all out. It's the other perspective of do-overs. But what did Moses do? He asked. He pleaded. He begged. He said, God, wait a minute. This is Numbers 14 and Exodus 32, two different events, both recorded down. He may have done it a third time, it's debatable. He said, God, wait a minute. You brought people out of Egypt. You did those wonderful things for them. What is everybody else going to think of you if you kill them off? Interesting. God actually cares what other people think of him. Because God said, okay, yeah, you're right. I won't kill them off. Both times. In this scenario, in Samuel's case, the people are worried God's going to kill us off. Yes, we deserve it. But Samuel said, no, he won't. And for the exact same reason that Moses, that God gave Moses the reason, the exact same reason that he did not kill him in Samuel's time, the same exact reason he didn't kill him in Moses' time. It points out in, verse 22. For the Lord shall not forsake his people. They weren't going to kill you off. Why? For the sake of his name. Moses evoked an emotion in God when he said, look what everybody else is going to think about and trash your name. And some would argue rightfully so. Well, that is an insult to him. He will not have his name trashed. So he said, okay, Moses, I'm not going to wipe him out this time. You go handle it. Of course, Moses kills a whole bunch of them. So some may argue the same day, paid the same price. Then again, in Numbers, of course, Moses, no, don't destroy them, God. It will destroy your name. Okay, I won't destroy them because of my name. Samuel said, God's not going to destroy you. Why? Because his name. He will not trash his name, drag it through the mud. Which I think is a beautiful statement, saying the same thing as, God may give me what I ask for. As he gave them the king that they asked for. It's by the consequences they're going to go through. He may give me what I ask for. And let me go through all those consequences of the big problems occur afterward. But he will not forget me. He will not abandon me. Because that would destroy his name. Yes, Bill.
Yeshua said, nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done.
Exactly. It's always a wise thing to do. It's always a wise thing to do. In spite of our own wills, we always have a desire to make them come true, but God's will is when it has to come true. And whether that is with a king and all its consequences or not, it still follows his will. He's not, he doesn't beat around the bush in that fashion. But what I think is a beautiful point is that each of us is the same scenario. We talk to our family. We talk to our friends. God, they, most of them at least, know that we try to follow God as best we can. If we get destroyed, what does that look like to the person who's looking at you? Oh, well, God clearly didn't like you. Or, your God isn't worth anything. Look at all the times you went to church. What did that get you? Look at all the times that, look what your children are doing.
I said to Jesus, "Life, God said, God will rest and deliver him out of it.
Yeah.
He didn't die."
No. God's name.
The name
well, right. That's from the size of it. Yeah. But God's name is extremely important to him. His reputation is what he values. I'm a human being. I'm really not worth a whole heck of a lot. I mean, honestly. But there's a lot of us. We have lots of people out here. Individually, not worth very much. But his name is so valuable to himself that he says, okay, because of who I am, I will not forget you. I will not destroy you. It's all we can ever account for and ask for. It's all we can ever need from him. Yes, we go to services. Yes, we go to high days if we can. We do various other things we can because we think he likes them. And he may or may not. I don't really know for sure. I haven't asked him personally. And he doesn't usually talk back too often either. So those things may or may not happen. But his name is what he actually values. His own personal reputation is what he cares about. Whatever we ask for, whatever we get, whatever we don't get, it's really no consequence to it. As long as his name, his reputation, doesn't get destroyed in the process. That's what he cares about. Hence, as Bill pointed out, may your will be done, not my own. We ask and we plead, but it still is always a caveat. It's always wisest to add, but may your will be done, not my own. Because unfortunately for the people of Samuel's time, their will was done, as well as God's, but their will was done. And they got some pretty bad apples in the process. Yes, Susan.
I was just going to say very quickly, that brings us back to the issue of kingship. You know, the servant bows the knee and says, you're the king. Your will be done. I mean, it brings it back to us too. The issue is God king, or is he not?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I always thought it was funny. I was talking to my wife this morning regarding the previous election that happened with the various people that were running for president. And I was talking about, well, okay, which candidate would God have wanted us to choose? And look, it's like, okay, oh, you know what? None of them on purpose. And by the way, there were three, in case you forgot. There were actually three candidates, or actually some argue four. There were more than just the two that we always think about. Because they aren't the king. They aren't the one that actually matters. It's his will that always matters. It was an interesting discussion, but that's about as far as it went.